Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Francesca Gaines. Francesca is Professor of Public Policy at the University of Manchester and Academic Co-Director of Policy at Manchester. And before academia, Francesca worked in local government and the probation service. Francesca has lots of research interests relating to cities. Today we're going to focus on her interest around gender, politics and devolution. Francesca, welcome to City Talks.
Thanks. Hi, Andrew.
So as a way to get into this this topic, can you just talk to us about the fascinating research you did back in 2014 looking at police and the crime commissioners and gender issues? And I think you've just recently updated that research as well, just to get us into these kind of questions and issues about how gender then impacts and relates to the policy agenda that different public figures undertake.
Yeah, this was research that I've been doing with my colleague and collaborator Vivian Lowndes at the University of Birmingham, and both of us are the kind of researchers that are very interested in how government and especially local government works, and we're interested in gender. So in 2012, when this whole new cadre of directly elected police and crime commissioners was elected, this was an absolutely fascinating territory for us, because, well, first of all, this was the first time there was this national cadre of directly elected politicians, and that's very different to you know, the Westminster government, to local government, other than the small number of city mayors. You had direct election, different way of getting political authority, whole new set of offices set up, and new working relationships, working between local government and partners and national government and the Home Secretary. So fascinating terrain. And then because we are both researchers who are interested in how gender works, both in how government organisations work, but also what that does to the policy process. How does it matter whether you have women making decisions, whether you have women being represented, how that plays out in policy? So what we did was, for the first few years of the Police and Crime Commissioners, we looked at everything that they produced, and we interviewed people in five areas. And we interviewed all the key people, the commissioners, the chief constables, the chief executives, the chairs of the panels that scrutinise police and crime commissioners. So we tried to get a picture of how they were working. And obviously one of the things we were interested in was, does having a female police and crime commissioner make a difference? And that was a big question, and it's a big question for researchers. And how does that representation work? And we were also interested in how, you know, where you have equalities legislation, how does that work? Does that change the way that processes work? And so what we did was we could see that all of the police and crime commissioners were being heavily lobbied by the Violence Against Women community to take action on the problem of violence against women. So every single police and crime commissioner in the country was facing that pressure, and the Home Secretary at the time, Theresa May, was very keen on this agenda and committing some serious government attention to it. But when we looked at their police and crime plans, we could see that less than half of the commissioners actually mentioned this as a policy priority. So we were really fascinated to work out what was going wrong, if you like, there in the policy process. So we crunched some numbers, and there are two key things that came out of that I think are very interesting and relevant to this agenda of women in politics. And the first thing that we found was that having a female police and crime commissioner meant that the problem of violence against women was twice as likely to be prioritised in those police and crime plans. Now, in a way, we could expect that. That confirmed our expectations. You would expect, perhaps, that women would be more likely to see this as a problem and prioritise it. Because, I should have said, crime is very gendered. And, you know, it's young men who face the problem of being victims in city centre violence, but it's women who largely face the problem of domestic and violence against women. So that was a not unsurprising finding, that having women made it twice as likely that this policy problem was looked at. And I think that finding really helps when you say to people, why does it matter having women in power in decision-making responsibilities? And it's because they bring a different agenda, different experiences, they add to the depth of understanding of policy problems. And I hope, Andrew, you and I'll go on to talk about some of the issues about getting more women into decision making.
Yes. No, we certainly will.
Our second finding was perhaps even more important, because it will take a while to get to a position where we have more diverse representation. And our second finding showed that in those police and crime commissioner offices where they took getting equalities evidence seriously, when they took their equalities duties seriously, and they looked at patterns of victimhood and asked for the statistics from the police and drew in understanding from talking to community groups, where that process happened, men and women police and crime commissioners were 2.5 times likely to prioritise that problem. So that's a very helpful finding, actually, because it shows that beyond the gender of the leader, that actually having an equalities perspective, getting the evidence, taking it seriously, can lead to what is effectively a better way of tackling a policy problem. And that's what we all want to get to.
Yeah, because it raises that you know, the issue that is often, you can see, you know, on the one hand, you know, the drive and the to get representation, to get more women into positions of power, as it were. But it also touches on the extent to which then the gender issues and sort of the women's agenda actually then plays out, whether the leader is a woman or not. Can you remember how many police and crime commissioners actually were women out of the total cohort, Francesca?
Yeah, initially there were only 6 women elected from a cadre of 41. Right. And that, you know, that's really problematic. And something went wrong, actually, there with the political processes, because there was an incredibly low number of women standing for election. And even by the elections in 2016, in 20 of the 40 police and crime commissioner areas, there were no female candidates whatsoever. And Well, I think because in order to get women coming forward to stand for office, there needs to be two things. Us academics call it supply and demand factors. So you need a supply of candidates coming forwards, and that means that potential candidates need to feel they will be supported, that they can do the job, And I think there's plenty of women out there who would really like to stand for office. So a bigger problem is the demand factor, and that is that mostly our system is supported by parties, and we need the parties to kind of demand women candidates. And without strong measures to support that process, we tend to revert to the expected, and people have a picture of what a politician looks like. And there seems to have been a particular problem with police and crime commissioners.
Is that because crime is a sort of, you know, is often regarded or thought about as a masculine kind of area of domain? I don't know.
It's certainly crime and policing is very, very masculine in terms of the makeup of police forces, but I think perhaps a bigger problem here, I think there were two problems with the Police and Crime Commissioner elections. One is that the Labour Party has been very good at running all women shortlists, and somehow they didn't for this agenda. And secondly, I think there may be an issue in that for women to overcome, I'm generalising, and this isn't the case for all women, but generally what's seen to be helpful for encouraging a greater number of women to come forward and stand, say, for the Westminster Parliament, has been kind of networks to support, peer networks, and for potential people who would really like to do it to look and see that there are people, role models that they can look at. And I think that there, with this new Police and Crime Commissioner role, that there weren't the peer networks to support people. In fact, I think it was uncertain whether this Police and Crime Commissioner role way back then was going to be a serious political player. And actually, over time, it has become clear that they are. And so people with some degree of experience and clout will go for it. In those initial elections, there was a strange bunch of people who stood for election, including lots of ex-military people, ex-police officers, and a high number of independent candidates were selected and elected, which is unusual. That's changed now after the second election. And I think by the 2016 election, it was much more, the parties recognised this was a serious political role with resources, power and clout. And so a more established kind of recruitment process took place, but without any of the special attention that needs to be given to encouraging and supporting women to stand.
I we'll come on to in a minute. I want to try and stay in this sort of representation sort of space for a moment. And we'll come on to in a moment, because you've also written about the first wave of the Metro Mayor elections, both in terms of who stood and obviously who won. We'll come on to that in a second. But just in terms of the representation, you've also, you point out that if you look at councillors more generally, or MPs more generally, and particularly the North West, I think you've written on, actually the representation seems to be more towards what we would expect if we look at, general shares of population and such. So just say something about that. And I wonder whether, is that because MPs and councillors, that's obviously a longer established position, and therefore, it's taken time to get up to that point, whereas police commissioners and obviously Metro Mayors are relatively new institutions, new imposed, and so it'll take us a while to get, to get that equal representation. But a lot, rambling from me, but just give us your kind of reflections on more general representation in councillors and in MPs, and then we'll get on to the Metro Mayors and your reflections on that.
Yeah, well, I think, if you had to sum up the gender representation in Parliament and in local government, you would say progress, but not fast enough. Right. So at the moment, 34% of MPs are women and 35% of councillors are women. And obviously, women are 51% of the population. So that's not where you'd want it to be. And I will come on, perhaps, Andrew, to say something about the nature of that representation and whether you need 51%. But just to sum up where we are. So That's where we are, about a third in the pool, if you like, the pool of people who will become the leaders and who will take decisions. So the pool of people who ask the important questions of leaders, it's getting better. It's not where it would be if it was to be entirely reflective of the population. And there are, since the 2019 elections, there are some pleasing changes. So, for instance, the Labour Party and the Lib Dem Party both have equal representation in their MPs, which is good. And there are also 17% are female MPs are women of colour, so that is representative of the broader population. So those are good things, but there are notable gaps and problems. And so, for instance, if I could point to, I think, the three areas where I think there is significant underrepresentation. And one is in the National Parliament is MPs who report as having a disability. And obviously the proportion of the population who are disabled is far higher. That the voice there is significantly lacking. There are no women of colour in the Scottish and Welsh Parliament and Assembly. And then perhaps the biggest problem is when you look at local representation and in local government and in the Police and Crime Commissioners and Metro Mayors. So only, I think it is 20%, 21% of, well, 21% of local authority leaders are women.
Right. Yeah.
Only 17% of Police and Crime Commissioners are women. Only 21% of the boards of combined authorities are women, so that's like the equivalent cabinet roles, yep. And none of the Metro Mayors.
0%, just for consistency, 0%.
Yeah, so what you're getting there is in those positions of, in local government, in sub-national government, in those positions of authority, those politicians who have decision-making power and resources, then you're slipping way back to very poor rates of representation, and I think that is problematic.
And I was suggesting, but I'm undoubtedly wrong, notwithstanding the sort of leadership versus, you know, the representation more generally, general point that you've just made, which I think is stark and is a challenging idea, is there something about newer institutions, and they, in a sense, they become, you know, they are dominated early on by men for long-standing reasons, and it takes a while then for the representation of women and indeed other interests to play into those sorts of institutions. I guess, you know, if we fast forward, let's say 10 years, would we be more confident that we would have at least one Metro Mayor or more than 70%, 17% of our police and crime commissioners being women? Is not that that's acceptable, but in a sense, is that how it plays out?
Well, you've got to hope so.
Well, on the Metro Mayors, we can't go down, right? I mean, I think, you know, in a sense that it's impossible to go lower than zero, at least, you know, in a kind of real world sense.
I mean, you can describe it as a cohort effect. So, for instance, in Greater Manchester, in the Manchester City Council has 51% women councillors. So you've got to hope that over time, you're going to end up with half of the executive members of Manchester City Council and perhaps the next leader of Manchester City Council being female. So obviously, what's key there to turn stronger, better levels of representation amongst those entrants to political institutions, what you need is to mentor, to support, and to see that follow through into getting the political experience and backing to become the leaders. So that's one thing. But there is this worry about retrenchment, and there does seem to be the reversion to the norm of a male, and often a white male politician. And So my colleagues, academics in Wales, will talk about how the Welsh Assembly slipped back from being 50-50 representation to being something more like a third, two-thirds. When you look in the civil service, under Sir Gus O'Donnell's leadership as head of the Home Civil Service, we had 50% permanent secretaries were women, and that's fallen back now to 34% or something. So I think you've got two effects going on there. You need the progression of women entrance to the political profession, and you've got to always guard against a reversion to some kind of male leadership model.
That's really interesting, because in a sense that would suggest that whilst peer effects are important, they're not significant enough in and of themselves to, in a sense, to allow progression they need to be reinforced by and underpinned by deliberate policies that are aimed very much at getting more representation, more diverse representation in our political life. And just not assuming that because we see more women in leadership positions, that in a sense, that is sufficient enough to drag the next lot of, women in just through imitation and peer effects. Is that right?
Yeah. And here's one very stark illustration of that problem, is that only, and I want to acknowledge the work done by the Fawcett Society in getting this data out there, but I think it is only 7% of councils have maternity support for their councillors, and only 8% of councils provide maternity provisions for their executive members. So you see, what happens is you get really smart, great young women coming in, being supported by parties, especially some parties, becoming clearly showing great propensity to become leaders, and then hitting that period of child rearing. And actually it becomes very hard to manage the two things without the kind of institutional and equalities legislation to support that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, and I want to come on to that, into the sort of the impact, I suppose, or, the way we have to think about these sorts of issues if we want more representation, and then obviously what the effects of having more representation, or better representation, as it were, actually are. But just to round off, I suppose, the representation question, can you just say something about, there's always this, at least from my sort of view, the sense as to whether, and I say this very crudely, whether men can actually represent women, and whether they can do that wholeheartedly and as well as women can represent women. Just walk us through that area. I'm going to say nothing more other than to walk me through this.
It's so important to ask, and it's a point I wanted to get across, which is in my kind of determination to argue for more women in politics, this, I am in no way wanting to fall into to be put in a corner of saying only women can represent women and men can never represent women, because that is not, patently not the case. There have been some superb male champions of feminism and of the kind of parliamentary reform that women need to be able to participate fully in public life. And there are also examples of women who patently do not represent other women. So my argument about getting, or the argument of myself and many others to get more women into politics, is because I firmly believe having a diversity of voices round the table is essential to getting just a better range of opinions and experiences and decisions and policy ideas and processes. It's the diversity that matters, because women are not homogeneous, and the risks of being affected by ill health, poverty, poor pay, poor housing. These are risks that are felt very differentially by women, and it is BAME women who bear those risks more. And so we it's not just getting more women into positions of power. We need diversity.
And that's what it is, isn't it? In a sense, it's part of that much bigger, well, a very big literature, which is about the inherent and indeed, you know, the explicit and the implicit benefits of diversity across, you know, across the public sphere, really, both in terms of outcomes, but also considerations and items on the agenda. And, you know, as you say, that applies not only to gender, it applies to class and it applies to race and it applies to kind of socioeconomic backgrounds more generally.
Yeah, which is why, you know, going back to that research that Vivian and I did about police and crime commissioners, this is why the second finding that actually taking equalities duties seriously,
yeah,
that's why it's so powerful, because it will be imperfect. The match between representation and diversity is going to be slower to get to where we want to be, and there will sometimes be a mismatch, but every leader can now use those duties to take a close look at the policy problems they're dealing with and how to target their resources best to address those problems. And you can do that absolutely now. And that's really important. And I you know, I've been reflecting on this a lot post-COVID in terms of the role of combined authorities and metro mayors. So perhaps we might move on to talk about that.
Yeah, we'll come on to that, definitely. But I want to just to carry on, well, to expand this theme a little bit, because I was also interested in the work that you did looking at sort of gender and how that played out in the coalition government, which was 2010 through to 15. And, you know, as a classic economist, you paraphrasing, you said on the one hand, you know, they did some good things, but on the other hand, they didn't do some, you know, didn't do such good things. But also, in a sense, what I found interesting, get you to say a little bit more, was, you know, you were kind of thinking about, well, they were doing so many very deliberate things which actually promoted gender equality, gender representation. But actually, some of the decisions they made, for example, on spending cuts and how that played out, had a disproportionate effect on women rather than necessarily than men.
If you're thinking about how policies might improve the situation of women, what we might say gender equality policies, they're broadly two types. There's one type of policy that targets women because of their sex, so it might be maternity, violence against women. Then there are policies that are aimed at the economic reasons why women don't get on. So maternity leave benefits and equal pay. So there are two different kinds, and often it's relatively cheap to address the status issues, but it's fantastically expensive to provide the fiscal support to, you know, to ensure equality. I mean, you only have to think about the pensions issue to realise how costly these things are. So what we found in looking at the coalition government is that there was, actually, Theresa May was quite a champion of violence against women, and she did commit resources and work very hard with, but she had to work with police and crime commissioners to try and get that issue on the agenda. And in fact, even in the recent COVID crisis, she's been speaking out about that.
Yes.
But the problem of the coalition government is, and this, you know, is substantiated by research from the House of Commons Library, is that it was women who bore the brunt of the tax and benefit changes to deal with austerity, to deal with the crisis. And so that's how you can get different kinds of policy impacts there.
And is that the institutional bias that you were you were talking about earlier on, Francesca, in the sense of the cuts that are made? Is there insufficient consideration given to, you know, to look at these issues through that kind of lens? Is that how you would explain those sorts of decisions?
I think that
or outcomes
that because it can be costly to deal with inequality, then it slips off the agenda when times are hard, and that we've tracked that since the Second World War. And you do see that when GDP is rising, there's more space, more political space and more economic space to take measures that are costly. And then when times are hard, the agenda shrinks. And this could happen. And well, that's one thing. I'll come back to that. The other thing is that I don't think there was good enough representation within the cabinet during the coalition years. And, you know, the Quad advising the Prime Minister of the coalition was all male. And we have, and you know, I fear that the same thing has happened recently, in that the Quad dealing with Corona has also been all male. And I fear that this meant that things like the position of women in abusive households during lockdown, the position of female care staff and elderly female residents, that these were not picked up on soon enough, because there wasn't that diversity around the cabinet table and specifically in the Quad.
And so when we think about public institutions, whether it's, you know, government in the broad sense, or the cabinet, I suppose, more particularly, that those making decisions, or combined authorities, you've talked about that, you know, in different parts of the country, or, you know, the leadership of councils. What should we be looking for to see, and really to try to get a handle on whether, you know, gender and gender issues are central and taken seriously by those different institutions? I mean, you know, to the uninitiated, what are the kind of signals or symbol that we should be really keeping an eye on to see what, you know, whether they are integral to what the decisions that are being made?
Well, I think it goes back to this cohort issue. And I think one of the things that, say, for example, has been done well in Greater Manchester was Andy Burnham appointed a female deputy, Bev Hughes, woman of immense experience over many years in government, and brought that into the region. And also ensured the cabinet, the mayor's cabinet, was de facto going to be male dominated, because only two of Greater Manchester's leaders were female, and that the cabinet's made up of the leaders, so that you got a situation there with 11 cabinet members, including the mayor, and only two women. But he or the authority ensured that there was a shadowing arrangement to achieve greater gender balance. Now, that may not be the whole solution, because then you need to work out how those shadowing arrangements are supported and enacted. But what that does is at least offer the opportunity for the next generation of leaders to get the experience of working in the combined authority, to see the reach, and that, you know, that it's a mentoring and a way of succession planning. So I think that's one thing to look at. Who's on the boards, and what arrangements are there to try and balance the boards where they are not through the existing leadership? Obviously, we want to look at who's standing. And, you know, I think it's very unlikely in the mayoral elections next year that we'll get a significant change. That there's a close election in Tees Valley, I think, and there are women candidates standing in various places, but the incumbency effect, I think it's unlikely that we'll see a massive improvement. Going back to the theme of what we've been saying, is the other thing that you want to see if you're looking is a strong equalities commitment. And, you know, combined authorities have budgets to, they have the ability to set industrial strategies, budgets around transport, adult education, housing, you know, and what you want is that for those decisions and those budgets to have an equalities assessment so that you can to look at it, and especially post-COVID, you know, that's become very apparent.
And is your sense of looking where we currently are, not just in terms of Greater Manchester, but elsewhere, that it is patchy in terms of the institution's commitment to that equality impact assessment, and then not only doing the assessment, which in some respects that's the first hurdle, but it's probably a lower hurdle, is actually then enacting what the impact assessment actually tells you, which, as you've already said very well, is that's where it gets into the, you know, into more, well, can be more challenging in a sense, because it often has cost implications associated with it, real implications associated with it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, every public official has equalities duties. So, you know, anyone in a political appointment or running an office for a political appointment should have equalities duties in mind. But let's be realistic. The one of the issues for these new, this gets back to your point, Andrew, really, about this, these are new institutions, and there isn't a lot of money provided to run the office, you know, and Greater Manchester in some ways has had an advantage because the Police and Crime Commissioner function is merged there. Then that did bring quite a big bureaucracy. As well as the authorities there had already committed to an economic unit. So there is a degree of capacity there. But even there, there isn't a lot of funding available to run the kind of staffing there that you might expect.
Yeah.
And I think for other areas, that's an even greater problem, that they just don't have the capacity, the analytical capacity. And you know, so that is going to be a problem in some ways in actually taking a look at what the policy problem is, or, you know, how you might want to address it and how that might have an equalities aspect. And in part that led to myself and colleagues at the University of Manchester putting together a publication that perhaps I'll let you have a link to, called On Gender, which tried to bring together what's for the policy areas that combined authorities have, which is, you know, skills, education, housing, transport, employment, tried to bring together what the evidence base was around gender and how nuanced that is, and what they could look at to see whether the what was happening and what policy levers they had, just to try and actually help get that knowledge out there.
And if you were, this is an unfair question, but if you were scoring the devolution agenda thus far from with a kind of gender kind of lens on, Francesca, I mean, you know, what would the, you know, you're an academic, you you mark papers. What would it be? You know, would it be a kind of A B plus? You know, need to do better. I mean, what's your kind of reflection on the devolution agenda that we've had, I suppose, since the first lot of mayors, you know, came in? Because obviously we were due to have a new lot of mayors literally now. They would be, you know, they would be just into office, but we'll get them next year. Notwithstanding that, it's likely that most of them, if not all of them, again, may well be men. But if you was, you know, if you were providing a scorecard for the first term from a gender perspective, what would you score them?
I think, quite honestly, I would say it's all to play for, which perhaps is a polite way of saying could do better. But I do not say that in a kind of, you know, in a judgmental sense, because I'm tremendously enthusiastic and heartened by these fledgling moves to devolution, and I want to support it. And as I say, I think you've got a new political office with very little resource. And let's face it, in an environment where there is no clarity about what funding is going to become available through the Shared Prosperity Fund, no clarity about the what will happen to the future of the business rate. You know, it's pretty hard for Metro mayors and combined authorities to find some space to deliver on. And I hope that will get better. But if it absolutely should have a gendered lens on the policy problems that they are charged with intervening in, because they'll achieve better if they do.
Exactly. No, and it's the core issue that we and obviously people like yourselves and others emphasize over and over, you know, the importance of building robust institutions that are adequately and appropriately resourced given, you know, the scale of the challenge and the task ahead of them. And that's a challenge in its own right. I mean, you know, what the challenge has just gone up, you know, exponentially gone up as a result of COVID. But really thinking very carefully about how we build and maintain really robust institutions that are really up to the tasks and the challenges that they face is just absolutely fundamental. Yeah.
Yeah, it is absolutely fundamental. And I think, you know, when you the reason why we've got Metro mayors in, well, there are lots of reasons. You know, I'm totally signed up to the fact that this gives a single powerful voice as an advocate and an ambassador. And it cuts through a swathe of meetings. It's a single focal accountable point. But if we go back to what George Osborne said, it was an amazing thing that the Treasury actually devolved those budgets, but they weren't going to do it without accountability. And how do you get accountability? And we don't want to go back to the days of the Metropolitan Councils and a whole elected cadre of, you know, that would, the public wouldn't bear the cost of that. Mayors are a cheaper and more, if you like, single point of accountability, but they need the resources in order to deliver good government, I think.
Yeah. Can we turn to, because you mentioned it earlier on, I'd be really interested in just your, you mentioned earlier on that you've been doing some research and some thinking on COVID and how that's going to, you know, how that, again, through this kind of lens and, you know, where you are with that. If you can share anything in your thinking to date on that, that would be, you know, that would bring us nice up to date. I suppose I should say, We are recording this on the 12th of June. So that's Friday, 12th of June. It's the very morning where we've just been told by the ONS what we all felt and feared, that essentially the economy has shrunk by, over the last couple of months, has shrunk by 25%, which is unprecedented to use that much overused word. So just tell us, you know, what your thinking is and what your work you've been doing on in relation to the COVID crisis.
Right. OK, well, I'll just start by very, very briefly just flipping pre-COVID and in the evidence from on gender that I was talking about that myself and colleagues brought together. What that showed was this picture of a structural gendered issue around women's engagement with the labour market. So very, very briefly, young girls and young men choose different educational subjects, different skills pathways. That leads to quite stark occupational segregation, with women often in the low paid, precarious roles around retail, hospitality, care, secretarial and administration. Men ending up in sometimes also precarious, but also often more secure, well-paid, managerial, professional, STEM, skilled trades sectors. And you can see that very starkly when you map it out by occupation. Then what you also see is that during the childbearing years, women are much more likely to stop working full-time and work part-time. That leads to gender pay gaps and there's much higher risk of disassociation from the labour market faced by some women, particularly BAME women or women in certain parts of regions, and insecure older age. So that is a gendered structural life course issue. So thinking about COVID, now the impact on our economy and economies everywhere is grievous. It is mind-boggling, and certainly as serious as at any time since the Second World War. So I think amongst many grievous and challenging things, if you look at what we know about what's happened to the economy, there are signs that women are going to take the hit because they're in those sectors that are going to find lockdown especially challenging, retail, hospitality, because they're likely to work in roles that can work from home, but more likely to perhaps end up doing more of the homeschooling. And that situation might go on for a long time. Women run small businesses in personal service sector may find it very much more difficult to manage, so that you lose them from the foundational economy. So there are all kinds of ways in which women may take the hit, and then hopefully, I'm really positive about this, combined authorities, through their local industrial strategies, through their budgets to commit skills, training, through their work on transport, that they hopefully have a huge role to play in trying to rebuild the economy. Now, and they will look at sectors that might grow, like green growth, the digital sector. And at the moment, those are sectors which are male dominated. So it's absolutely going to be essential to retrain, reskill, to ensure more gender balanced workplaces in the economy to come. And also, you know, this might be, I'm sure lots of fathers have enjoyed lockdown because they've been able to spend more time at home, and we want to capture that too. And so there's a huge role for combined authorities and a very gendered aspect, I think, to what they need to do in this very, very challenging time ahead.
And that perfectly brings together, I suppose, two of the kind of themes that we've talked through this podcast, which is about, you know, the interconnection between the importance of representation, not just for representation's sake, but for other, you know, for actually the meaningful reasons that actually affects the decisions that are made, and therefore the impacts that are felt by places and by people.
You won't be able to deliver the policy solutions that you want to deliver without understanding the policy problem, and you can't understand the policy problem without a diversity of voices contributing to understanding that and understanding the diversity of experience.
A fantastic way to finish a fascinating conversation. Francesca, thank you very much indeed for being my guest today on City Talks. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.